the book of Exodus, chapter 1, verse 1.
Book of Exodus, chapter 1, verse 1.
And these are the names of the children of Israel who came to Egypt. Each man and his household came with Jacob. Reuben, Simeon, Levi, and Judah. Issachar, Zebulun, and Benjamin. Dan, Naphtali, Gad, and Asher. All those who were descendants of Jacob were 70 persons. For Joseph was in Egypt already. And Joseph died, and his brothers, and all that generation. But the children of Israel were fruitful, and increased abundantly, multiplied, and grew exceedingly mighty, and the land was filled with them. Now there arose a new king over Egypt, who did not know Joseph. And he said to his people, "Behold, the people of the children of Israel are more and mightier than we. Come, let us deal wisely with them, lest they multiply, and it happen in the event of war, that they also join our enemies and fight against us, and so go up out of the land." Therefore, they set taskmasters over them to afflict them with their burdens. And they built for Pharaoh supply cities, Pithom and Ramesses. But the more they afflicted them, the more they multiplied and grew. And they were in dread of the children of Israel. So the Egyptians made the children of Israel serve with rigor. They made their lives bitter with hard bondage, in mortar, in brick, and in all manner of service in the field. All their service in which they made them serve was with rigor. Then the king of Egypt spoke to the Hebrew midwives, of whom the name of the one was Shipra, and the name of the other Puah. And he said, "When you do the duties of a midwife for the Hebrew women, and see them on the birth stools, if it is a son, then you shall kill him. But if it is a daughter, then she shall live." But the midwives feared God, and did not do as the king of Egypt commanded them, but saved the male children alive. So the king of Egypt called for the midwives and said to them, "Why have you done this thing and saved the male children alive?" And the midwives said to Pharaoh, "Because the Hebrew women are not like the Egyptian women, for they are lively and give birth before the midwives come to them. Therefore God dealt well with the midwives, and the people multiplied and grew very mighty. And so it was, because the midwives feared God, that he provided households for them." So Pharaoh commanded all his people, saying, "Every son who is born, you shall cast into the river, and every daughter you shall save alive." And the man of the house of Levi went and took as wife a daughter of Levi. And the woman conceived, bore a son. When she saw that he was a beautiful child, she hid him for 3 months. But when she could no longer hide him, she took an ark of papyrus for him,
daubed it with bitumen and pitch, put the child in it, and laid it in the reeds by the river's bank. And his sister stood afar off to know what would be done to him. And the daughter of Pharaoh came down to wash herself at the river. And her maidens walked along the river's side. And when she saw the ark among the reeds, she sent her slave girl to get it. And when she had opened it, she saw the child. And behold, the babe wept. And she had compassion on him and said, "This is one of the Hebrews' children." Then his sister said to Pharaoh's daughter, "Shall I go and call a nurse for you from the Hebrew women, that she may nurse the child for you?" And Pharaoh's daughter said to her, "Go." So the girl went and called the child's mother. Then Pharaoh's daughter said to her, "Take this child away and nurse him for me, and I will give you your wages." So the woman took the child and nursed him. And the child grew, and she brought him to Pharaoh's daughter, and he became her son. So she called his name Moses, saying, "Because I drew him out of the water." Now it came to pass in those days, when Moses was grown, that he went out to his brethren and looked on their burdens. And he saw an Egyptian beating a Hebrew, one of his brethren. So he looked this way, that way. And when he saw no one, he killed the Egyptian and hid him in the sand. And when he went out the second day, behold, two Hebrew men were fighting. And he said to the one who did the wrong, "Why are you striking your neighbor?" Then he said, "Who made you a prince and a judge over us? Do you intend to kill me as you killed the Egyptian?" So Moses feared and said, "Surely this thing is known." When Pharaoh heard of this matter, he sought to kill Moses. But Moses fled from the face of Pharaoh and dwelt in the land of Midian. And he sat down by a well. Now the priest of Midian had seven daughters, and they came and drew water, and they filled the troughs to water their father's flock. Then the shepherds came and drove them away. But Moses stood up and helped them and watered their flock. When they came to rule their father, he said, "How is it that you have come so soon today?" And they said, "An Egyptian delivered us from the hand of the shepherds, and he also drew enough water for us and watered the flock." So he said to his daughters, "And where is he? Why is it that you have left the man? Call him that he may eat bread." Then Moses was content to live with the man, and he gave Zipporah, his daughter, to Moses, and she bore him a son, and he called his name Gershon, for he said, "I have been a stranger in a foreign land." Now it happened after many days that the king of Egypt died.
And the children of Israel groaned because of the bondage, and they cried out. And their cry came up to God because of the bondage. So God heard their groaning, and God remembered his covenant with Abraham, with Isaac, and with Jacob. And God looked on the children of Israel, and God cared about them. The title of the second book in the Bible, Exodus, comes from the Greek Old Testament, meaning the going out. And this book records the great deliverance which God wrought when he brought his people, the children of Israel, out of the bondage of Egypt. And the first few verses of the book form a bridge, a connecting link with the latter section of the book of Genesis. And that is made abundantly clear, both by the opening words themselves, literally, and these are the names of the sons of Israel who came into Egypt. Egypt being the last word you find in the book of Genesis. It links directly onto that. And you add to that the repeated references to Jacob and Joseph in the opening verses of Exodus, which two men dominated the latter half of the book of Genesis. But the main purpose of chapters 1 and 2 is simply to set the scene for the great confrontation between the Lord, represented by his servants Moses and Aaron, and the might and power of Egypt, represented by its king and Pharaoh, brought to a dramatic conclusion by the liberation of Israel from bondage and the death of the then Pharaoh, together with his elite Egyptian cavalry. So in a sense, therefore, chapters 1 and 2 are largely concerned with setting the stage, introducing us to the principal characters in the drama that is to follow. And yet, in themselves, these chapters are packed tight with instruction for us. Probably more than anything else, they confront us with the working of God's providence. And it is that I would like us to take away with us this evening. That there is a God who, though largely unseen, is there and is active behind the scenes. A God who is in control and who somehow manages to bring his will and purpose to pass, in spite of the opposition and hatred of bad men, as in chapter 1, and the failure and undue haste of good men, as in chapter 2. Now, I said largely unseen, because you might have noticed in our reading that God is only actually mentioned in connection with the courage of the midwives, or chief midwives, in chapter 1, and with the people's desperate plight and calling out to him at the end of chapter 2, and apart from that, you do not see him. Long before, God had promised Abraham that he would make his descendants into a great nation. And chapter 1 of Exodus is largely concerned with God's preparation of that nation. And it is important that we note that the opening verses draw attention to two facts in particular. First, that Jacob's direct descendants, who went down from Canaan into Egypt, numbered only 70. And second, that they there increased in a most remarkable and unnatural manner. As Moses later said to Israel in the book of Deuteronomy, "Your fathers went down to Egypt with 70 persons, and now the Lord your God has made you as the stars of heaven in multitude." Now, our passage emphasizes Israel's rapid population growth by expressing it, in one verse, in no less than 5 ways. The children of Israel were fruitful and increased abundantly. That is, they swarmed, they teemed. They multiplied and grew exceedingly mighty. The land was filled with them. That this was God's doing is made clear in that the very language used here in Exodus 1 matches closely the language of God's great creatorial commands back in Genesis chapter 1. Be fruitful, increase abundantly, teem, that is, multiply, fill. The land of Egypt was in fact the only place on earth which offered space and opportunity for the family of Jacob to expand into a nation which, based on the fact that about 600,000 men of military age came out of Egypt, according to chapter 12, to expand into a nation which must therefore have numbered well in excess of 2 million. There was no way that Jacob's family could have reached such proportions or become exceedingly mighty if they had remained in Canaan. The existing Canaanite tribes, nations, and clans would have wiped them out well in advance of that. On one occasion, Jacob accused two of his sons, "You have made me stink among the inhabitants of the land, among the Canaanites. They will gather themselves together against me, and I shall be destroyed, my household and I." Now, that never actually happened, but the threat was there. You imagine trying to grow 70 into over 2 million people. They would not have stood for it. Even, you note, the king of Egypt became apprehensive, uneasy about their spectacular growth, viewing them as a very real threat, even to him. And yet, on the other hand, the descendants of Jacob frankly didn't stand a dog's chance of tackling and conquering the Canaanite tribes unless first they became that big. And even then, it wasn't a picnic. Egypt, therefore, was the place which the all-wise God chose as the incubator in which Israel could grow. But their time of sojourn in Egypt fulfilled a second, equally important purpose. The land of Canaan was highly dangerous from the standpoint of the purity of their faith. The name of the game among the clans and nations of Canaan was mixing, intermingling. Hamor, one of Canaan's chieftain kings, had suggested free intermarriage between his people and the family of Jacob. Events overtook that, but that was how he thought. And already Esau, that's Jacob's brother, and Judah, that's Jacob's son, had married Canaanites. The writing was on the wall, really. God's chosen people were in very real danger of losing their identity, of being absorbed both socially and spiritually into the surrounding pagan nations with their gods. No such danger existed in Egypt. The Egyptians were separatists, disdaining all foreigners, underline the word all, and abhorring shepherds in particular, which is what Jacob's family were, a fact exploited to the full by Joseph when wanting to secure the land of Goshen for them, but that's another story. Israel's isolation in Egypt was then desperately important if they were to preserve their spiritual identity, if they were to remain the people of God. Now, the man that God used to get the family to Egypt was Joseph. And the Spirit of God reminds you of that, effectively, in the opening section. For in the first 8 verses, his name pops up 3 times. Now, certainly it had not been any easy ride for Joseph, being sold by his own brothers to the Ishmaelites, by the Ishmaelites to Potiphar, cast by Potiphar into prison, and the rest. But we know, as Joseph came to know, that the Lord was above all, accomplishing his own purpose through it all. As Joseph explained to his brothers, "It was not you who sent me here, but God." But in Exodus chapter 1, God also overruled the hostility and persecution of the Pharaohs to make Egypt a jolly uncomfortable and unpleasant place for Israel. God stood behind Israel's trials, permitting them, as the psalmist, Psalm 105, put it, "He increased his people greatly and made them stronger than their enemies. He turned their heart to hate his people, to deal craftily with his servants." The point being that otherwise, as a developing nation within Egypt, they would have been sorely tempted to stay where they were. If everything was smooth and comfortable, then they probably would have responded much as the later Jews did when given the opportunity of returning from their exile to their own land. When a mere 50,000 took up the offer and the rest stayed and lived happily ever after or whatever. Israel's afflictions came, as you read, in 2 main stages. First, the Egyptians, in the person of the then Pharaoh, enslaved them, appointed taskmasters, and afflicted them cruelly. Well, that's verses 8 to 14. The intention, obvious enough, to wear them down physically, to crush their spirit, and to restrain this abnormal population growth. But the king of Egypt saw it as being an extremely shrewd move, enabling him to kill 2 birds at one time, with one stone. Because it enabled him to secure for himself a large labor force to help with his big building projects. But we notice the opening of verse 12. But the more they afflicted them, the more they multiplied and grew. And God had turned Pharaoh's vaunted wisdom and cunning scheme to foolishness. And so secondly, the king of Egypt decided to tighten the screws and to have all the Hebrew male babies put to death, initially on the sly, secretly undercover, attempting to turn Israel's midwives into their executioners. But because of the faith and courage of the chief midwives, now you might immediately stop me and say, "You keep saying they're the chief midwives." Well, frankly, 2 midwives weren't enough to go around, even if they had the productivity rate of you, Miss Jones. They would never have coped. And you might have noticed in verse 19 that when the 2 midwives are speaking to the Pharaoh, they say the Hebrew women are delivered before the midwives arrive. These are the bosses. These are the people in charge of an army of midwives. But because of their faith, if you will excuse some rather awful puns, Pharaoh's ill-conceived plan miscarried. Because the chief midwives feared God more than they feared Pharaoh. And that forced his hand. Forced the king of Egypt to come out into the open. To involve, we read it, all his people in the planned genocide. Personally, I think it more than coincidence that some 40 years later, it was the Egyptian male children, the firstborn, who perished during the night of the Exodus Passover, and that again, it was the Egyptian males, and males only, Pharaoh's elite cavalry, who were drowned in the waters of the Red Sea. You plunge a Hebrew baby, male baby, into the water and drown it. Read the Song of Moses in chapter 15. He just kept coming back to it. He cast them into the sea. Strong enough to tackle the Canaanites? Sighed, cried to God by reason of their severe bondage. To a man, they were ready to go. But God was not only preparing the people, he was also preparing their deliverer. Because while Pharaoh was busy plotting Israel's extermination, which, as you can imagine, would have followed inevitably if there were no male. While Pharaoh was busy plotting their extermination, God was preparing for their emancipation. Moses, a remarkable man in every way. He was the child of a slave, yet he was the son of a queen, a princess at least. That, actually, there was a slight risk with saying queen there. It all depends whether this was Hatshepsut or not. Don't worry. He was a child of a slave, but he was a son of an Egyptian princess at least. He was born in slavery, but he grew up in a palace. He inherited poverty, but enjoyed fabulous wealth. He was the keeper of sheep, yet he led an army. He was educated in the wisdom of Egypt. Stephen said that in the New Testament. Yet he had the faith of a child. He was at home in the royal court, but spent 2/3 of his life in the wilderness. He was backward in his speech, yet he talked with God. He carried nothing but the rod of a shepherd, but with that rod, he wielded the power of Almighty God. He was born under sentence of death and lived for 120 years. He was a remarkable man. God overruled the home into which Moses arrived. Born to parents of great faith and courage, otherwise he would have perished at birth. New Testament says, by faith, Moses, when he was born, was hidden 3 months by his parents because they saw he was a beautiful child and they were not afraid of the king's command. Full marks to mum and dad. But God preserved Moses from being drowned in the river, not only by the faith of his parents, but the compassion of Pharaoh's daughter, who, as we read, saw the child. I tell you, that was an electric moment. When she opened that box, that basket, she saw the child. I guess Miriam held her breath. And behold, the baby wept, and she had compassion on him. It's been well said that big doors often swing on small hinges. And in one sense at least, on the tears of that baby rested the defeat and downfall of a pharaoh, the preservation of a whole nation, and the faithfulness of God's promises to the patriarchs. just as the envy of Joseph's brethren was the means under God to bring about what they most feared, Joseph's exaltation, so the oppression of Israel by Egypt's kings was the means under God to bring about what they most feared, that, in the language of chapter 1, Israel would get them up out of the land. He that sat in the heavens laughed. Pharaoh's own daughter ended up paying Moses' natural mother for her services as his wet nurse. And Pharaoh himself ended up providing home, upkeep, and education for the future deliverer of Israel from Egypt. God was at work behind the scenes, ensuring, among other things, that his and Israel's future ambassador to the court of a later Pharaoh was familiar with the workings of the royal court. He'd grown up there. That the man who was to communicate and codify his laws, that's God's laws, to write the first 5 books of our Bible, was given the best education available anywhere in the world. God saw to that. Oh yeah, God was very much in control. The very malice of his enemies chained to the chariot wheels of his purpose. During his 40 years in Egypt, Moses grew to be a man with many sterling qualities, not least, as we've read, that of the champion, the deliverer of the oppressed, the ill-treated, the downtrodden, of which we met no less than 3 examples in chapter 2. But if you were the underdog, this was the man to stand up for you. There were a lot of good things you could say about Moses, but Moses was distinctively a man of faith, following closely the steps of his parents. The New Testament says, by faith Moses, when he became of age, he was actually 40 years of age, refused to be called the son of Pharaoh's daughter, choosing rather to suffer affliction with the people of God than to enjoy the passing pleasures of sin, esteeming the reproach of Christ greater riches than the treasures in Egypt, for he looked away to the recompense. Now it's clear from that, there is no other way of interpreting it indeed, that Moses made his life-changing decision to throw in his lot with God's people before he went out to look on them and their burdens, which is how chapter 11, chapter 2, verse 11, describes it. He went out to look on them and their burdens. It's something that is said of God himself at the end of the chapter, verse 25. Because though he had been raised in the comforts of Egypt and educated in their best universities, Moses' heart was a reflection of the heart of God, looking with compassion and pity on the afflicted. So no, Moses did not forfeit his position, his status, as the son of Pharaoh's daughter when he killed the Egyptian. It did not cost him that. He renounced that position first, preferring to be known as a son of Abraham than the son of Pharaoh's daughter. The world lay at his feet. Its wealth, its glory, its power and position, its pomp and prestige, and he trampled on it all But what kind of man, we must ask, would value hardship above comfort, reproach above honor, poverty above treasure, shame above fame, a slave camp above a palace, enduring affliction above enjoying untold treasure? What kind of man? In the eyes of the world, I guess, only a madman. But Moses was no fool. It was simply that his faith laid hold on another world. And in the light of that world, he simply weighed the issues of time in the balances of eternity, and he reached a perfectly sane decision. Indeed, he reached the only intelligent decision, and plumped for the most valuable, and he went for that. And yet, Moses still wasn't ready, wasn't fully equipped for the work God had in store for him. And so God overruled Moses' haste and impatience to enroll him on a course of further education, lasting a second 40 years, but this time not in the universities of Egypt, but in the fields of Midian, keeping sheep. And there in God's college, he learnt lessons in how you keep sheep together, lead them into places of pasture and refreshment, round up the strays, wait patiently for stragglers to catch up, protect the flock from its enemies, and prevent rebels determined to wander away. And all that was part of God's preparation of his man, his servant, the training of Moses to become, as the great prophet Isaiah once described him, the shepherd of his, that is God's flock, training him. By the end of chapter 2, the stage was set. All the props were in place. All the key characters are on stage. The action is about to begin, and the spark's about to fly. So you can't afford to miss Mervyn on the 12th of June, when he tells you what happens next. But meanwhile, we can each take away the assurance that in a way that I am altogether unable to explain, frankly, I haven't a clue about it. That is honest. I haven't. But in a way that I can't explain, in spite of the rage of his enemies and the failures of his friends, God is in control of whatever happens in the world and in our lives. And we enjoy the assurance, we indulge in the luxury, I suppose, this week, of knowing, I do it, that my life, all the circumstances of my life, are safe in God's hands. Exodus 1 and 2. Tell me that. Here then, in the opening of Exodus 2, we discover God's plan for the salvation and deliverance of his people. Certainly didn't look very promising. Just a man, a woman, and a baby. Whoever would have thought that you would find God's appointed Savior and Deliverer lying in a papyrus basket? But then we read in the opening of Luke chapter 2 in the New Testament of another man, woman, and a baby over 1500 years later. And again we discover God's plan of salvation and deliverance, this time from a more severe and fearful bondage than even that of Egypt. But who would ever have thought that you would find God's appointed Savior and Deliverer lying in an animal's feeding trough? Shall we pray?